We're doing Parshat Lech Lecha. This is our first class this semester. Our goal in the Parshat class is to try to cover the stories of the Torah, try to glean from the wisdom of the commentaries, be it halachic, be it also the philosophies in the Parsha. Much of Jewish philosophy is hidden in the commentaries on the Torah. Being that this is our first class on Parsha this semester, so we'll do a quick overview of the Torah until here. So the Torah begins with creation. Our tradition is that creation involves tremendous secrets. We don't exactly understand what the Torah is telling us there. That deserves a class in its own right. Why does the Torah start with something we don't understand? So Bereishis describes creation, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They have four children, Cain and his twin sister, Abel and his twin sister. We know that Adam misquotes the prohibition that God gives him, and he tells Eve she shouldn't eat or touch from the fruit, and then she touches and sees she doesn't die, so she thinks Adam lied about everything, and then she eats, and she sees she's going to die, and she doesn't want Adam to marry another woman, so she feeds him from the fruit, and suddenly he realizes, hey, what'd you just do to me? I don't feel the same as I did before. And she has, by eating from the fruit and feeding him from the fruit, she has changed the world forever. She has changed his makeup, and from now on he will die, and so will she. It'll take him 1,000 years to get there, but he will die. And then he gets punished, and she gets punished. Childbirth is going to be painful, and he's going to have to work for a living, etc. They get kicked out of the Garden of Eden with their children, and Cain and Abel bring sacrifices. Cain takes from the worst of his animals. Abel takes from the best of his crops. God responds positively to Abel's offering and not to Cain. Cain is jealous. God tells him, you could fix what you've done, but he takes the easier route out and he murders Hevel, his brother Abel. Two birds come down and one bird brings its dead friend and buries it before Adam and Eve to teach them how to bury the dead. And then God punishes Cain. We run through the end of Bereishis and we see a dismal picture where people use their force to steal from one another to the point where people are stealing one another's wives and humanity has quickly gone downward. The ethics have evaporated. People are taking everything from one another and it's survival of the fittest. People are adopting paganism and God sends a warning and he sends a prophet and he sends a tsunami after that warning and a third of civilization dies and none of this helps. And so a child is born. He is the first child to be born with fingers that are not webbed. They name him Noach. They recognize life is going to be more convenient if people are going to be born with separated fingers. They will be able to master developing tools. So Noach is a kind person. He has a wife, Naama, and they have three children. It takes them years, centuries to have these children. Imagine what Noach's life was like. He lived four centuries before having his first child. Can you imagine living four centuries? You understand what four centuries is, guys? 400 years ago. Let's think for a minute. We're in the year 212 now. That means 1600s. Yes, Noah lived from the 1600s to now. Yes, before he had his first child. Can you imagine that?
Living. Development wasn't as much as it was.
Fine, but can you imagine what a life, 400 years? Wouldn't you get tired of life after 400 years? And then he finally has a child. Now, Noah. He's very punny. We're in Parshas Noach. So God tells Noach there's going to be a flood. He should start building an ark. Takes him 120 years. Guys, let's imagine again, that's from 1894 to now. 1894, did any of you meet anyone that lived in 1894? I married to meet someone who lived in the 1800s. So we had, there are a lot of people who lived to 100 these days, right?
Did we take those?
That's a long class, but we're just doing a quick overview here. Our parish is Lech Lecha, so for now we're taking them literally. Yes, it would seem like we take them literally. So Noach's going to take 120 years to build this ark. That's more than a lifetime today, yeah? 120 years where all civilization is going to say there's this weirdo building this huge thing. And they ask him, and he says, this is an ark. God's going to bring a flood. And eventually he's right, right? He has two of each animal, and some of the pure animals, seven of each, they go into the ark, and there's a flood that takes about a year, and all of civilization is wiped out, And then after the flood, God makes this promise, I'm not going to do this anymore. I will not destroy all of civilization. Yes?
Some of the exercises we have is in the commentaries to compare Noah to Abraham. Right? I'd say the difference, the main difference that Abraham cared about...
Sorry, Amir, that's too long when I have only 25 minutes and I haven't hit Lech Lecha. Sorry, Thursday night we'll talk. This is just a quick overview. So at any rate... Noach comes out and he starts civilization again, which is very, very hard. He's got to start from scratch, and nothing personal. Noach and his three sons, they were prohibited from being intimate in the ark. Now they come out, they can again rejoin their wives, and Noach plants a vineyard, and a miraculous thing happens. It grows in that first day. He drinks from it, he gets drunk, he walks around naked. And he's divided all of earth between his three sons. And Ham tells his brothers, that old man is going to have more kids. And then we're going to have to divide it with more of us. So between him and his son, they castrate and rape their father. And when Noah wakes up, he realizes what they've done to him. And he curses them. Ham and Canaan are going to be cursed. The man Ham, Noah's son, has a child named Mitzrayim. What we call Mitzrayim, Egypt, began with a man named Mitzrayim. One of the wonderful things that Moshe did when he gave us the Torah was he traced civilization back to the flood. That's why the Torah goes to great lengths to explain to you there was a man named Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz means Germany. There was a man named Ashkenaz, and the Torah traces whose son he was. There was a man named Madai, Mede. The Torah traces them. As you go through the parasha, you see there was a man named Edom. There was a man named Seir. The different countries have names. Coming back to our parasha. So at the end of Parshas Noach, we encounter a man named Avram. Avram is 75 years old. He, in his younger years, he married his niece Sarai when she was orphaned, and he adopted his nephew, her brother Lot, when he was orphaned. In a nutshell, Avram was a kid. Yeah, so you guys know the story about his father's idol shop.
Yes.
Okay. So his father does something very strange. His father, when he sees his son has gone out against paganism, his father gives him over to Nimrod to be killed. Okay, in a nutshell, quick story. His father, Terach, has a baby. And Nimrod, the king, has a vision that this baby is going to be a renegade. He's going to lead a revolution against paganism. So he tells Terach, I want you to give me your son to kill, and it's the greatest service you can do to all civilization, and I will reward you. And Terach says, give me 3 days to think about it. And then he comes back to Nimrod and he says, you know, I was given a tremendous horse. You gave me a gift, a tremendous, tremendous horse that I value and cherish. And now someone's offering me a lot of money for that horse, but I feel like it would be a great disrespect to you to give up that horse. Do you agree with me that I shouldn't succumb? It doesn't matter how much money I'm offered. So Nimrod says, of course, a gift that I gave you, you should never give up. So Terach says, well, I was given this gift, this child, and you want me to give him up for money? And Nimrod says, you have a good point, but give me the kid. And Terach goes home, he's not sure what to do, and then he takes one of his servants' babies and he brings it to Nimrod, who steps on it and kills the kid, and rewards Terach with a lot of money. Terach sends his wife out to a cave with the baby Avram, and there are different versions as to how the story ends up, but Avram grows up away from civilization, which gives us an insight into Avram's capacity to go against all of society, because he didn't grow up with the norms of society. So Avram is this super genius at a very young age. Avram says, this is ridiculous, why are you guys all bowing to these idols? And at some point, Terach actually gives Avram over to Nimrod to be executed. And Nimrod jails Avram for 10 years. Avram spends 3 years in one jail, 7 years in another jail. They tell him they're going to blind him. They keep him in a dungeon. And instead, he spends all those years writing 400 chapters of philosophy, why a person should be a monotheist. And at the end of the day, they bring him up to this great challenge. They put him in a great coliseum. And everyone's going to witness how Avram's going to give in and bow. And he doesn't. And then they tell him, Now we're going to line up your whole family, and they're all going to bow to idols. And they line up the whole family, and everyone agrees to bow. And they say, Avram, will you? And Avram says, no. And they heat up this huge furnace where you had to stay a huge distance. You couldn't even approach the furnace without getting burnt. And they tell Avram, you're going in there if you don't bow to the idol. And everyone's watching, and Avram says, no. And they're going to show. And they tell Avram, do you believe your God could save you from that furnace? And Avram says, yeah. Now there's one person in Avram's family, his brother Haran, who they ask him, will you bow? And Haran says, you know what, let me think about it. Let's see what happens with Avram, and then I'll answer you. So they put him on the sidelines, and the rest of the story we know. They throw Avram into the furnace, and Avram walks out unscathed. And then they ask Haran, will you bow to the idol? And Haran says, no. And they throw him into the furnace, and he burns. He dies before Avram's eyes. Because God doesn't do miracles when we do things with that expectation, he'll do a miracle. And that's what we have with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They also said, we don't know if God will save us or not. He could save us from a furnace. So Avram then adopts his niece and nephew. And this is one of the lessons we're going to see as a recurring theme in the Torah. Just because I do what's right doesn't mean all of life is going to be a bed of roses. Maybe the thorns of the roses are there too. Avram is saved, but he loses his brother. And now Avram is invited by Hashem after he's visited in the land of Canaan. He is now back outside the land of Canaan, and God tells him, go, leave your family, leave your comfort zone, go to the land I will show you, and there you will become great, and everyone's going to want to be a part of you. And so God doesn't tell him where to go. So Avram starts traveling. So where's the most natural place for him to go? The land of Canaan. He knows that in Israel, there's a natural affinity to monotheism. And it's interesting. We see that countries develop the people. We think that we develop the country. Well, the country also affects us. There's a reason why in French, they are more attracted to wine and other things. There's a reason why in Italy, they have a certain temper. There's a reason why people from different countries have certain temperaments. And we're taught this, our sages pointed out from the book of Genesis, from Parshas Bereishis, that we're affected by the land. You'll see the Jews are also affected. You'll see, people have temperaments. There's a reason why there are all kinds of jokes about Moroccan men and Moroccan women, and Yemenites and Ethiopians and Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardi Jews. And at the end of the day, the prototypes have a certain relevance. There's a reason why you could walk down the street and you could recognize the chutznik. How come? Wait, he got all the clothing like an Israeli, went to an Israeli barber, he's doing everything like an Israeli, and yet everyone can tell he's an American. Why? Okay. How? He didn't open his mouth. They didn't hear the accent. Yeah, there's the look. There are a lot of things about it. A person, depending on where he is. So Avram knows that in the land of Israel, people are affected by the way language affects us too. It's not only the earth you stand on and the diet you eat and the air you breathe and the people you interact with. The language has a great impact on the person. The language, Lashon HaKodesh, doesn't really have any vulgar words. They're all words that we take in from other languages. There's no real word in Hebrew for even the organs that are used for intimacy. If you look in the Gemara, they don't have a name. In modern Hebrew, I talk to my kids. I talk to them about their bris milah and their diaper area. Because what am I supposed to say? There's no real word for it. If a kid has jock itch, you got to talk to him about what's going on. If he needs something, right? How are you going to discuss it with him? So you talk about the diaper area. You talk to kids about privacy, that no one should be touching them. You say what's covered when you wear underwear. No one belongs there, right? So there is no real word in Hebrew for all that. How does the Gemara talk about intimacy? The Gemara calls it tashmish amita, use of the bed. That's how, use of the bed. How do you say a bathroom? Beit hakiseh, the place with a seat. The house with a seat.
I still don't understand, because you both spoke at the same time. The use of the
what? Bed. The use of the bed. Bed.
Oh, bed. Got it.
Use of the bed. I'm saying, what's the male organ called? The aver, the limb. Can I say? What's urine called? Mei raglaim. The water of the feet. The water of the feet. That's urine. So that's why it's Lashon HaKodesh. It's the holy language, which has no word that's not holy, and that affects a person when you talk Lashon HaKodesh. So I remember when we first made Aliyah, so my brother and I were discussing how we think differently when we talk Hebrew. And then we said, yeah, because we grew up in English. So in English, we know all the curse words. In Hebrew, it's new to us. Then we learned that there isn't really in Hebrew any curse words. It's okay. What?
Substituted.
Yeah, it's imported. Yeah. Back to our parasha. So Avram says, God's going to tell me where to go. Meanwhile, I'm traveling. He travels to the land of Israel because that makes the most sense. And he's 75 years old. This is the second time he's in Israel. He was in Israel when he was 70. We'll see the end of the parasha is a flashback to what happened when he was 70. So God told him it's going to be real good, Avram. You're going to be wealthy. You're going to be famous. And he enters the land of Israel. And for the first time in world history, there's a famine. No food. So God told him, Avram, go. You're going to be wealthy. And he loses every penny he owns. He goes into debt. So that's a wonderful thing if you think about it. Here Hashem gave him a promise, you're going to be wealthy, you're going to be famous, things are going to work out well. He comes into the land of Israel, and the first time in world history there's a famine, and the first time in Avram's gone bankrupt, he has to take loans. So now, life is an Olech Hadash. Wow. But, Avram could have said, Ribbono Shel Olam, I understand you had to bring a famine into the world, but couldn't you bring me into Israel a year afterwards? You know, I have to make Aliyah in order to make Yeridah. There was really room to ask questions. And he didn't have answers. Sometimes we look at Avram and we think he had answers. And one of the wonderful things you'll see throughout the parasha is that when Avram has room for questions, suddenly Hashem doesn't say anything. Wait a second, you got me into this. Tell me, what am I supposed to do now? Hashem doesn't say anything. So now Avram's got a deal. And very often when a person chooses a path like Avram Avinu, Lech Lecha, Hashem tells him, go to be yourself. You're not going to realize your potential in Chutz Arts. You want to be Avram? You better go to Israel. You don't belong out here. Lech Lecha, the story of Avram begins with the commandment, you're going for you. We like to think we're doing God the favor. Hashem says, no, you want to realize who Avram is. You want to really develop your soul? You go to the land of Israel. And so Avram comes into the land of Israel, and things don't work out right. Life was good in Chutz Laretz. I knew what I was doing. I had my contacts. I was making money. And here? So it's not working out. And he has no choice. He travels south to Mitzrayim. And as they're approaching Mitzrayim, he sees the people's colors are changing. They're all dark. So he looks at Sarai and he says, you know, I've always known you were beautiful, but now we have to worry about your beauty. Sarai was one of the most beautiful women that ever lived. It says, any woman next to Sarai looked like a monkey. So it says. So she's an old woman already. She's 65. If Avram's 75, she's 10 years younger, we'll see later on. So she's 65. So he says, you know, the Egyptians are going to kill me and marry you. So I need you to say you're my sister. And then she could have just said, I'm a woman, one of his servants, one of the women out here. But no, say you're my sister, and then they'll all try to give me gifts to convince me, to convince you to marry them. So Avram takes a first thing he says, that's the worst case scenario. First case scenario, he puts her in a box, and he locks up the box, and he says, no one has to see you. And they come into Egypt, and as they're crossing the border, they tell him you have to pay taxes. And he says, fine, so they tell him what's in the box. So he says, it doesn't matter. So they say, you have to pay taxes. You guys know the story? Can I skip it? Yeah? Okay, so I'll skip the story. Sarai gets taken by Pharaoh when they force him to open the box, and they see her, and they say, who are you to have a woman like this? He says, she's my sister. What?
Is this Aminash?
Yes, Medrash Tanchuma.
The other story was also.
Which one?
The Colosseum and
correct. It's a different Medrash. The box?
I don't know this.
I said the one before where they asked him to bow and then they threw him into the furnace. Okay, back to our they tell him, who are you to have a woman like that? She belongs by a king. So they bring her to the king Pharaoh and she starts weeping. She says, God, you promised Avram, but what about me? I believed in you. And now one of the things we have to remind ourselves is that we know the end of the story, but they didn't. So when Sarai was taken to Pharaoh, in her mind, it's over. She's never going to see Avram again. She doesn't know that in a matter of a day or two, she's going to be released. In her mind, it's finished. The king just abducted her. So here God told him, Avram, go to the land of Israel. Things are going to go well for you. It's going to be real good. And everything turns out backwards. Far worse than he could have imagined. Isn't that interesting? How does a person deal there? When we learn these lessons, we're supposed to be learning from Avram. What does that mean, learning from Avram? That means that in a person's life, a person will do what's right, and the outcome will not necessarily be pleasant. And sometimes a person can look at it and say, God, you did that. That didn't have to happen this way. And if you were going to get into the picture and I was doing what right, wouldn't I be fair in expecting you should get into the picture and help me? But you got involved in the picture to make it worse for me. It didn't have to happen this way. Sometimes you see a person dies. And you see the amount of errors that happened in the hospital. It was like God's hand was guiding them to mess up. And you say, why did it have to go this way? We were once considering whether it's a good idea to do an epidural or not. So an epidural. When a woman's giving birth today, they can do an epidural where they basically put a needle with certain... I don't even know what they're putting in, injecting, but they numb the woman from the waist down so she doesn't feel the pain of childbirth. So I asked a friend of mine, an anesthesiologist, I asked him, we heard about a woman who became paralyzed from this. So he said to me, the number of mistakes that that hospital had to do in order to make her paralyzed is not something you can expect would ever happen. It wasn't one mistake. It was mistake after mistake after mistake, which led to that outcome. You don't have to worry that such thing would happen. But you look at that and you say, if the woman knows that and her husband knows that, then they look at it and they say, wait a second. Imagine, let's just say for argument's sake, not that this is real, but I'm saying imagine if this woman didn't want to have children. And she went to a shir and she heard a class where they told her, you know, your mitzvah is to have children. And then she went to have the child. And then she went to a rabbi and asked, should I do an epidural? And the rabbi said, technically, there's no reason not to. Why should you suffer if you can avoid suffering? So she listened to the halacha and got pregnant. And she listened to the rabbi and took the epidural. And now she's paralyzed. How is she going to look back at that? Again, I made up the story. But you could imagine that in people's lives, sometimes things play out that way. So here it's worse. God spoke to him. God said to him, go. And God didn't just tell him, go. God gave him a guarantee. God said, it's going to be good for you. You're going to be rich. You're going to have a good life there. And suddenly he comes to Israel and it's not playing out the way he thought. And that's the story of life. We do what's right and suddenly we get curveballs. And we look at it and we don't understand. And Moshe says to Hashem when he's on Mount Sinai, he says, Hashem, can you explain to me what's going on in the world? Can you explain to me why things are so complicated? And Hashem says to Moshe, "Ve'ra'it et achorai." In hindsight, you can understand. "Ufanai lo yera'u." But you cannot see life. You cannot see life as you're living it and understand it. No. "Ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai." You cannot live through life and understand the curveballs that are being thrown at you. That's life. And when we look at Avram and we say we have to learn from Avram, he's gonna cross 10 hurdles. 10 tests, that means we look at Avram and we say, wait, what am I supposed to learn from here? I'm supposed to learn how a Jew is supposed to live his life. Where, I had a project, which unfortunately I'm not able to finish. I was interviewing people who survived the Holocaust and remained observant. And I'd always tell them, I understand every person who stopped being observant. No question. I don't understand the people who remained observant. I would like to understand what it is, what philosophy you adopted, how you dealt with what you saw to remain observant. And I wrote it down, and unfortunately, I don't have that many people left to interview. You know, the generation is passing from the world. That's why I'm saying I don't think I'll be able to finish the project. But it's fascinating. People's own grandchildren never asked them this question. And the answers people give you are mind-boggling. They're not what you think. What's an example? Wouldn't you want to know? I'll tell you one example. One example that really struck me from a woman who's no longer with us. She told me that after the Holocaust, she said, I don't understand what God did. I don't have answers for that. And she reached a conclusion that she doesn't think she'll die knowing. And so at one point she said to herself, why should I continue doing this? And then she looked at the atrocities of the Holocaust and she said to herself, how can I ensure that my own children won't become Nazis one day? She said, walking away from it all, I said to myself, there's one thing that's really important to me, that I can ensure that I won't become them. And she said, her conclusion was the only way she can ensure that her family remains ethical and moral is by remaining observant. And she brought up, when she was 16, she had to go, after the Holocaust, she went to live with family. And her relatives were all non-observant, to the point where they went to a restaurant and she asked, is it kosher? And they asked her, why do you care? And she said, I'm not going to eat it if it's not kosher. And they said, look at everyone around you. We're all Jews. We're all eating here. So they stopped the waiter and they asked the waiter, is it kosher? So the waiter said, no. So they said, what do you mean? So the waiter, the family said, what do you mean? The kosher? The waiter said, look at the menu. It says kosher style. We're serving you gefilte fish, but it's not with kosher fish. It's kosher style. She remained observant. Then she built a phenomenal family. That was one answer. You guys want one answer? At any rate, when we look at Avram, the greatness of Avram is that he doesn't have answers. I have a lot of answers, but let's move forward into the parasha. The greatness is the ability to say, to discern between the fact that I don't have an answer, that question which I still have, doesn't disprove what I did know. Avram knows Hashem is real, and Avram knows Hashem is true, but he doesn't understand everything Hashem does, and that's the way we lead our lives. We don't understand everything Hashem does. There are certain things that we look at and say, that's amazing, and then there are things we look at and we say, why? And we don't have an answer. The challenge is not to let that question contradict what we do know. And Avram stays steadfast. And so Pharaoh gets punished and he releases Sarah. And he comes to Avram and he says, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? And to add salt injury, why didn't you tell me she was your sister? So you make money off of this whole deal. But it's okay, take her and you could have her. You could have everything with you. And they send him out of the country because Pharaoh knows he can't trust his people with Sarah. By the way, what year was Avram born in? 1948, right. What year was the great Palaga, the great divide, where all of earth was divided into languages, etc.?
The year of the Tower of Babel.
Right, 1997. He was 49 years old. And what year does Avram enter the land of Israel for the first time when he's 70 years old? Do a quick math.
2018,
right, we're almost there. And then he comes back 5 years later in 2023. What?
What happened
to the 2018? I don't know. So now he's very wealthy, and Avram revisits all the inns he had used on his way down. So the simple understanding is he's repaying all his debts. He's paying back. But our sages say we learn from Avram, if you got good service, don't change. Very often, we are not loyal customers. And our sages say learn from Avram. Where you got good service, you should come back and give your patronage. So Avram comes back, and his relative Lot is also very wealthy. And Lot's shepherds all say, look at Avram, he's not going to have any kids. So when God says he's going to inherit the land of Israel, it must mean that Lot will inherit the land of Israel. And so Avram's shepherds say, you guys have no right to take this, it's not yours. And Lot's shepherds say, come on, God says it's all coming to Avram. Obviously, it means it's Lot's. And Avram's shepherds say, yeah, but even Avram isn't taking the territory yet. And here you see a very, very important fine line, which you'll see often in your life. Very often, people will steal in the name of piety. They'll steal to do something very pious. But they're using forbidden money. And then they'll give all kinds of excuses and answers. And it's tempting sometimes. And here's the first time you see it. And Avram tells Lot, we shouldn't fight publicly. And that's another important point. When you have a fight, very often the intelligent person has to know to keep it private. Don't hang your dirty laundry outside. Avram tells Lot, it's not nice in front of all these nations. We're going to have a fight. You choose where you want to go, and I'll choose where, and I'll go the opposite direction. And sometimes the best way to maintain the peace is to separate. And so Lot looks around, and he sees the beaches, and he sees the women, and he says, Sodom and Amorah, come on, there's so many beautiful women there, that's where I want to go. So he takes his cattle, he takes his wealth, and he goes in that direction. So here's the big challenge. Where do you want to live, guys? Where are you going to build your families? That's the major challenge when you leave Mahon Meir. We had a wedding last night. None of you were there, right? No, we had a wedding, an alumni of ours. That's why I wasn't here last night. I remember when that student came to the Mahon. He studied here for 2 months. He had an apartment in Tel Aviv. And he came and asked me, what should I do? Where should I live? And I said, move to Kiryat Moshe. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm in a lease in Tel Aviv. I said, find someone else. You want to grow? You want to really lead an observant life? Move to Kiryat Moshe. He said, the rent is high and the apartments are cheap. I said, cheap, not in a good way. I said, yeah, but you'll be near the yeshiva. You will grow. You will develop a life. You will end up marrying a different person. You will be a different person. Not so long ago, he came back to me and said it was the best move he made in his life. And I'm telling you, don't underestimate it. When you see in our parsha, Avram and Lot choose where they're going to live, and Lot looks at the wealth and the girls and the beach, and he says, I want to live there. Oh yeah, it's tempting. I've mentioned that I had years where I wasn't convinced I was going to be observant. And much of my teenage life, I was debating. And one of the things I was debating was, I said, I could be a lawyer with a pool and a lot of other nice things in life. I had dreams in the material world, and it's normal. A person does have aspirations, and you can live a good life, a materially good life. But when you choose where you're going to live, remember the guiding principle. You have a family, and we end up being our surroundings, and we end up being our children's education. What they learn is what we become. And so people have made this mistake throughout history. I can't say online, but I'll give you a few examples. We have to end class now to be continued.